some reflections on what it is that binds us and makes this rather peculiar monastery hang together in some kind of gravity-defying way. And there's one sutta where the Buddha gives some advice to a married couple, and they come to him and they say, "Lord, we're very happy, we love each other very much, and we would like to be together, not just in this life, but also in the next life as well." So, of course, this is a rather extraordinary state of affairs. And shows that, I guess, it is possible. And so as monastics, of course, part of our professional interest is to be as cynical as possible about marriage. When I was in Bodhinyana, we discussed discussed with approval when we heard the news that there were these chanting monk bots in Japan, where you've got like a fiberglass or something figure of a monk in a robe, and then you pay coin into it and then he does the chanting for you. And we all thought that this was a wonderful idea. And we were talking about getting some at Bodhinyana, and particularly you could get one to do like pre-recorded counselling and advice and so on. And you can have like a row of options to choose. You have kind of marriage problems, and you just press the button, and then the it says, "What do you expect?" So, or you can have like the advice for the Thai ladies, which usually consists of chai, 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 which just means, "Oh yeah, really, okay, yeah." So anyway, this was our rather cynical take on that, but. And just, you know, in this particular sutta, when they come to the Buddha, he doesn't tell them, you know, "You're just attached to each other," or anything like that, and doesn't try to teach them to practice. You know, doesn't say that, you know, attachment is the root of suffering or anything like that. He gives them some straightforward advice, and I think that's a very important little lesson there. First of all, on the nature of attachment. Which is that, you know, attachment is attachment. Attachment isn't attachments, as they say. Like oils ain't oils, but attachments ain't attachments either. And there's all kinds of desires and wants and needs and so on that we have. And many of them are not particularly harmful. In fact, many of them may be useful and may be beneficial. And particularly at certain stages in our growth, that some of them are essential. And it's essential that a little baby develops an attachment for its mother and for its father. It's an essential part of a normal, healthy growth. It's only later that they need to learn about letting go. So similarly, in that kind of relationship, if people are thriving and doing well from that, then it's good to encourage that if you see that people are going on well. So that's part of the thing about attachment, but also part of the thing about teaching Dhamma is not to do it in a mechanical way, and that of course that teaching could have been done very differently to different people. And also to be careful as monastics or people sort of intent on the monastic path, not to have an air of superiority about that. And you know, in many cases it may well be true that you know, we kind of valorize the holy life and valorize the celibate life, life of chastity, and believe that it's something that is conducive for us to help our way to Nibbana. And there's no doubt that that's true. In one way or another. But the way that it applies is different for every person, and there's also some sense in which probably, certainly some of us, perhaps all of us, are also just on an escape route from commitment or, you know, emotional vulnerability or whatever it is that comes with intimacy and so on. And the people who decide to engage with that, and particularly people who succeed in committing and sustaining that, there's certainly a lot of letting go involved in that as well. So it's important not to sort of have a kind of superior attitude about these things. Just because our life choice is leading us in a different way, it doesn't necessarily mean that for us that's we're on a higher kind of spiritual plane than someone who's made another choice. And of course, the very fact of thinking that itself is just conceit. So the Buddha's response was, he mentioned two things which is useful, if I remember the sutta rightly. And one was having the same sila, and the other one having the same view. Elsewhere, I think it also mentions having the same faith somewhere, I can't remember quite which, and the other qualities as well, but this particular one I'm thinking of, I think it says the same sila and the same view. And with regards to the same sila, of course, what that means is that the choices that we make, or the ethical choices that we make in some sense, are compatible. If one person is you know, behaving in one way, another person's and the other person finds that to be unethical, to be wrong, then it's very difficult to sustain that kind of relationship over a long term. And the other thing, the same view here, having a same view is a similar meaning to having the same faith. Basically, it means that they have the same, they're committed to, say, the same religion or the same kind of similar kind of outlook on life. It wouldn't necessarily mean that you know, you had the same you adhered to the same religion. Of course, it might mean that you have respect for each other's religions or faiths or something like that, if they had different faiths. So these same ideas, I think, apply very much within the monastic community, and are some of the things which help the community to bind together. And with the same sila, of course, what we mean by that is that there's a reasonably consistent or coherent spectrum of interpretation of the Vinaya and of the precepts as the different stages of or different kind of platforms, ordination platforms, and agarikas and novices and fully ordained and so on, that there's a reasonably consistent approach to the Vinaya within that. Of course, you'll never find a where everyone agrees on every little point of interpretation. And I don't, you know, forget about, you know, community. I don't think you find two monks that agree on the same vinaya points and everything. Ajahn Brahm's remark about that in the context of cheese was, he said, when he was a young monk, he used to argue about it, and now he's an old monk, he just eats it. So I think that's kind of fair enough. And there is a very interesting passage where in the Majjhima Nikaya where Ananda raises the concern with the Buddha about, you know, what happens when you pass away if the monks don't agree about interpretation of Vinaya and the Patimokkha. And the Buddha said, dispute about the Patimokkha is trifling. But if anybody disputes about the way of practice, about the Eightfold Path or the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, then that will be brought along for the harm and destruction of many people. So having the same sila doesn't necessarily mean, so it doesn't mean at all that everybody agrees about the same definition of everything. For example, eating cheese in the afternoon. You know, there's a famous schism in the monastic community. Is cheese navanitang? Navanitang is allowable to eat in the afternoon. When they translated navanitang in Thai, they translated it as nei. Traditional Thai culture, they have very few dairy products. And so when they were translating the Indian texts, which of course have many dairy products, they didn't really know what they were talking about. So they translated navanitang as ni, and then in the modern era when they came in contact with the Europeans, they translated both butter as ni and cheese also as ni. And so then they said, oh well, ni is allowable in the afternoon, so let's go for it. And of course there's a big dispute about whether navanitang really is could be considered as cheese, since in ancient India of course they don't have cheese as we know it. There's a famous verse of homage to Krishna, which goes something like Om Navanita Lipta, something, something, something. Homage to one whose limbs are smeared or massaged with Navanita, which I like to translate as cheddar. Homage to him who has cheddar massaged into his body. Perhaps in that context might be oil or something like that might be better. Anyway, so there's this kind of dispute in the Sangha, and it's not really kind of resolved. These days when I travel around Singapore and Malaysia, everyone's kind of giving me cheese all the time. And of course the funniest thing was when I went to the Thai temple in Canberra, and they're having a cup of coffee in the evening before the Dhamma talk, and then he said, Sai Nui Mai? And I'm like, I couldn't, sorry? Sai Nui Mai? Sorry? I couldn't quite catch that. Sai Nui Mai? Oh, no, no, please don't put any cheese in the coffee. So what to do about this then? So we don't always agree on all of these things, but we agree enough to get by. Yeah? And like any kind of legal system in the Vinaya, it's subject to interpretation, and different people will quite validly have different interpretations of it. And like any legal system, it has to be applied not only literally, but also with wisdom and with kindness. And, you know, any legal system, you know, you'll know that the police don't always apply all of the road rules 100%. The local council doesn't always insist on every regulation that's on the books. And everything, that's how legal systems work. Rules are made with an idea in a certain context, and then we try to apply them in different contexts, and they don't always work as they were originally intended. So we have to use our discretion when understanding and applying those things. So, of course, we come from a tradition which kind of tends to the side of literalism in understanding the vineyard and applying the vineyard. And we try to say, well, if that's what it says, then we do it. That's the basic assumption. And in doing so, we've generally speaking discovered, and this was the discovery made by the generation of Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah and so on, they pretty much found that usually when you do that, it works. A surprising amount of times when you just apply the vineyard in a literal and straightforward way, even though it might look a bit extreme or incomprehensible or something, but usually it works quite well. And so that's what the vineyard practice of the forest tradition is based on. So in applying this question of samasila, keeping like a similar standard of sila and precepts and things, then it's always good to reflect on that as being part of a community. That, you know, in certain cases that you know, we might understand a particular precept or something in a different way, but you know, it's a nice thing to go along with the community, as long as you're not doing anything that's wrong or anything that's like against the vineyard or something. But just to try to interpret it in a way that's as harmonious as possible. And you know, you notice that staying in monasteries, whenever you see monks who you know, very insistent on their own particular way, it's got to be like this, you know, this way of doing vineyard and so on, that it's difficult for monks like that to sort of be part of and really build a community in harmony. Whereas those who are more flexible and more able to see what's going on and to adapt to it, then they get along better in a community. And this is one of the qualities that you learn, or that I learned when I was in Thailand doing the kind of the monastic training, is just that thing that in being aware of what's going on around you, paying attention to what's happening, even though sometimes you'd really rather not bother, you'd rather just forget about it, get back to your kuti and do some meditation, but which, you know, which of course is good, but also just not to pretend that it's nothing to do with you. Yeah? If you're living in a monastery, we had this was the kind of mantra that we used to have at the Bodhinyana for a while. Nothing to do with me. Something you can't, somebody ring up or something like that. Nothing to do with me. And this was the half joking mantra that was going on, but it certainly expressed a kind of felt attitude within some of us at the time. And so we shouldn't ever think, you know, really, I mean, okay, joking around is one thing, but nothing that happens in the monastery really is nothing to do with you. Everything is to do with you in some way or another, yeah? And everything affects everybody else. So when we're making our choices, then always to think about what's the impact on others as well. What's the impact on the other people? Very often, you know, as a generalization in how to be in and how to work within a monastery, as a generalization, the best way of doing it with sampajanya is when you're with people that you're with them 100%, and then when the business or whatever you have together is finished, then you go back and you're in seclusion 100%. And though that's very important to really put a lot of effort into maintaining that. Whatever you're doing, 100%. That's one of the things of sampajanya, clear comprehension. We're working 100%. If we're talking with each other, we're talking with each other 100%. We're drinking a cup of coffee, drink a cup of coffee 100%. Doing the chanting, do that 100%. Going to meditate back at our kuti, we do that 100%. And just as a sense of responsibility and commitment helps to spread among the community when you're doing your work and your chores, to take care with that, to put effort into making a good job, to see that if you're entrusted with a task that you do everything you can to bring that to completion effectively, without taking too long about it, without doing a sloppy job, without getting distracted into metaphysics, etc., etc. And at the same way, also to reflect that when leaving the community, when the lunchtime is finished and we finish the washing up and what we have to do, we leave, we go into seclusion, we go to our kuti or to our room or caravan or whatever it is, that also is a contribution to the monastery and a contribution to the community, and it's part of our sila. And one of the most inspiring things about a forest monastery is when you arrive, and especially you arrive in the afternoon or when it's not chores time or something, and there's no one there. And I think that's very inspiring. Everyone's back at their kuti doing their meditation. And if you do have some work or some project to be doing on in the house, that's fine, but just getting on with that, you know, not to be messing around too much. So even the Buddha used to feel that it was too much hassle sometimes. And there's one kind of famous passage, and he said, "Here I am hemmed in with bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, laymen, laywomen, always coming and hassling me, asking questions and stuff. Why don't I just disappear?" So he just grabs his bowl and robes and walks off into the forest. And everyone's going like, "Where's the Buddha gone? What's he doing?" Ananda says, "Just chill out, guys, okay? He's just going off to do some retreat." So I think that's a very nice thing. It's not, you know, the need to withdraw and to go into retreat. It's not a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of anything's wrong. Yeah, even the Buddha would do it. So if you need to do that and go into a period of more retreat and more seclusion, then that's what you need to do. If you can do that within the structure, the confines of the structure of the ordinary monastery structure, then that's good. If you feel you need more time, or time off chores, or something like that, then just ask. Yeah? And if it's possible, then we'll always do what we can to accommodate that. And, you know, in doing that, you're always contributing something. If you need to just go to your kuti for a few days and just cry, that's all right too. That's giving an example to others that's perfectly okay. So everything that we're doing is something which is shared. This is one of the aspects of a monastic community. Nothing we do is just us. It's not just about me. My issues. And then the other thing is the sama dipi. This is sama with one M and a short A. Not the sama, but the sama, meaning same view. And same view. You know, I mean, I must say that I find when people really have the same view, I find it incredibly annoying. And I mean, that's something actually completely drives me away from people, is when they agree with you about everything. But what was the thing Venerable Tapasi showed me today? Never trust a subordinate who never disagrees with their leader or something like that. I think that's quite good. So it doesn't mean you don't have any disagreement or dissent, just like in the Sama Sila, it doesn't mean you don't have any disagreement about the vinaya or different ways of doing things. But it does mean that there's a... I think it means you've got a similar perspective in that sense. You've got a similar perspective, a similar way of looking at things. And that really struck me, the difference between when I was in Watanachat and when I went to Bodhinyana. And that was a very, very striking difference. And at Watanachat, there was much more emphasis on external conformity, doing the same thing at the same time in the same way, and that was very strongly emphasized. But in my time there, I never felt that the Sangha was particularly harmonious. I never felt that there was a particular amount of actual like inner feeling of commitment and brothership among the Sangha. I mean, it's not to say that it was completely unlike that, but it was just, I found it was quite disparate a lot of the time. Whereas when I went to Bodhinyana, it was very striking, the difference, the warmth of the monks, and the feeling that, just the feeling that everybody's there for the same reason, and everybody's committed to the path, everyone enjoys Ajahn Brahm's teachings and we're going on. Not to say that there wasn't dissension and discussion and so on. On the contrary, there was quite an energetic, a lively culture of Dhamma discussion and so on that went on in that period of time. But it was all within a similar kind of framework, a similar kind of perspective. So this is something which we develop primarily through three things. One is through study, and especially if we study similar texts, and of course primarily being the suttas, and if everyone has an understanding of what the suttas say, then we share a vocabulary. We share a common stock of ideas that we can use to frame our Dhamma understanding with. And this also is something which I found to be true at Bodhinyana, but which I know was not true at Watanachat and at other monasteries I'm also aware of, where a lot of the monks actually don't know anything about the suttas and they have never read them and are not interested in them. And so that level of understanding and being able to discuss on those things is just not there. So it's one thing is important. And so the study of the suttas, the discussion of them, so the ability to be able to talk about those texts and to accommodate and appreciate different points of views on the texts. Of course, everybody brings something different to them. I had a bit of a one of Venerable Analio's recent articles that arrived. It was on the Gandhaba, which arrived when we were at the conference in KL. He mailed around, and he was quoting from, I can't remember now, one of the Buddhist scholars who said, rather than trying to develop a theory on the text or something, it's best to let the text speak for themselves. And I must admit I disagree very strongly with this idea, because of course the texts never speak for themselves. If you leave texts to themselves, they sit on a library shelf. They never say anything to anyone. And there's no such thing as a text which which there's no such thing as like a set or received meaning of a text. But I think that that meaning is something that arises in the relationship between a reader and a text. And that the text will have a certain... the meaning of a text is not completely open. It has a certain range of possible interpretations, which is not limited. But still, a text can't mean just anything at all. And in the different ways of understanding that we bring to the text, that there are these are in that moment, as we engage with it through reading, through discussing, through contemplating, through chanting, and so on, when the text comes to life in that moment, then that's where meaning happens. That's when those teachings which the Buddha gave 2,500 years ago, actually the meaning sparks from them. And the important thing about a text is that is precisely that moment. If the text is sparking meaning, then there's a point to reading it. Otherwise it just becomes a topic for academic discussion. But there actually has to be that kind of spark of meaning. And the problem is that, like any spark, it doesn't stay alive. It only lasts for a very short amount of time. And then it dissipates again. So through our reading, contemplation, discussion and so on, we need to be able to spark that meaning and somehow to keep it alive, somehow to keep on fanning it. And so we do that by always challenging our own interpretation, our own understanding. So when somebody asked Bhante Agacitta about this, he said, they asked about, you know, how much should we be studying things that are kind of non-core subjects in Buddhism, you know, things that may be peripheral to the Buddhist studies. And he said that's fine to do that, but to make sure that you have a really good grounding on the suttas. So once you have a good grounding on the suttas, then all of those other things that you may be interested in, you can see them in some perspective. So of course the fruit of that study and discussion happens when the mind is clear and has the clarity that will allow it to synthesize a new insight. And wisdom in Buddhism is not, it's got nothing to do with like an instrumental understanding. Okay, so it's nothing to do with that understanding details of things and how they work. It's got to do solely with the ability to let go of our ignorance, defilements and attachments. And this is something which is often misunderstood. We have this idea sometimes that conceptual understanding is inferior because you get attached to the knowledge, or this is only conventional truth and we want the ultimate truth and all of that kind of stuff. And that's all not how the Buddha put it at all. The way that Buddha put it is that the wisdom that is right is the wisdom, precisely that wisdom which leads to letting go. And that wisdom which leads to letting go can come from anywhere. So wherever that comes from, that's the right place, if it leads to letting go. So that the depth of wisdom is determined by the source of it. Sorry, not by the source of it, by the outcome of it. Not by the whether it's ultimate truth or conventional truth or any of these kinds of things. And of course there are plenty of examples in the suttas where people become enlightened by means of a metaphor. Yeah, I went into my heart, I pulled out the wick, and the lamp went out. And with the quenching of the lamp, my mind was freed. Yeah, so this is just a metaphor for the mind. And yet, the result is freedom. Yeah. So, and the Buddha said, you know, sometimes you can get enlightened while listening to a Dhamma talk, sometimes while chanting, sometimes in all these different circumstances in our lives. Any moment it can happen. Ananda got enlightened while he was lying down to have a rest. Another monk in the commentaries got enlightened while listening to a slave woman sing about the suffering of life. So that could have applied to Jason and Nilushi the other day at the village hall. Sitting in meditation, listening to Nick Cave. You actually missed your opportunity there. That could have been a could have been a great chance. So it doesn't matter where it comes from. What matters is how it affects you, how real it is for you. So that requirement of right view, or something, not right view, of samadhi, of the same faith or same view, same opinion, same perspective, isn't about making sure everyone can write a list of the same kind of dogmas that they agree to. And that's what they do, for example, in a lot of the... I had a friend who's a monk, and his parents were into the kind of American Christian scene, and he said that that's what they would normally do, that typically if you joined a particular Christian group or another, and of course there's hundreds of them, that typically they would give you like a set of dogmas to sign off on, and people would get them and compare with the kind of which list of dogmas that they agreed to, and then you kind of sign off on that and say, oh yeah, I can agree with that. So this isn't the kind of thing that we do in Buddhism, generally speaking. But as long as we preserve that similar perspective, that we have a commitment, an appreciation of the Four Noble Truths as being the guiding principles in our spiritual path, and then on top of that to keep that commitment of inquiry going on, that kind of restless seeking after knowledge and after understanding, in order to deepen our apprehension of the Four Noble Truths, then that kind of shared perspective, this is what I see as being the real meaning of the shared view or shared faith. And again, by cultivating these things, and by taking these things on board for yourself, then in this perspective, you know, you're not just working for your own liberation, but also helping and supporting those around you. We can help to kind of raise the Dhamma, the level of Dhamma understanding, level of Dhamma intelligence within the community. Each person studying, practicing diligently, trying to see the meaning of the Dhamma, and then having that kind of level of understanding within the community as a whole. then we all, in this way, we all help to support each other. I remember when I used to play football at school, then they would always say a team of champions will always be beaten by a champion team. So I think that's pretty much true in a monastery as well. So if we want to be the champion monastery, then which we should try to be the best monastery in the world. I think we already are, but that's just my opinion. I'm biased, so I don't regard that as a completely objective assessment. Then to be a champion team, and to be a champion team doesn't mean it depends what kind of game you're playing, doesn't it? Yeah, because I used to do rowing. So if you're doing rowing, basically everybody's doing exactly the same thing at exactly the same time, right? So you want, and everyone has to be basically the same. If you had a team of robots doing it, would be the ideal one. Whereas if you're playing football or cricket or something like that, you need a diversity of skills. And that's really what we're after, isn't it? We want a diversity of skills. We don't want everybody to be able to do the same thing. We want people to be able to do different things. And in doing different things, we contribute to the monastery in different ways. So please to appreciate that and to have this kind of mudita for the contribution of others. And sometimes that contribution is to be able to just be very quiet and to go back to your kuti and do some meditation. And for some people that's their best contribution. For some people it's in practical things. For some people it's in an educational vocation. Or a creative contribution, and so on and so forth. So many things that all come together to make a monastery. So the more we can have that that kind of uses this phrase in the Padimokkha, when we finish reciting the Padimokkha, it says that thus all in harmony with mutual rejoicing. Sammodana, mutual rejoicing. And without disputing. Yeah, we should train ourselves. And so this is, that encapsulates the essence of what the Padimokkha is and the essence of the lifestyle is. Yeah? Tata sabbe heva. Tata in the Padimokkha. Sabbe heva. All heva is emphatic, each and every one. Sabbe heva, samagehi, samodamanehi. In harmony, with, mutual rejoicing without disputing. And so that aspect of mutual rejoicing is very important. It's not just an absence. It's not just an absence of dispute. So harmony is more than just avivadamana, avivadamanehi. It's not just non-disputing. But it's also an active rejoicing, an ability to look at the contribution and to appreciate the contribution that everybody makes. And some people make that contribution through offering dana, and some people make the contribution through just being here when they're needed. Yeah? Some people make the contribution by being somebody who you can talk to when you're in trouble and you need someone to listen. Yeah? Some people make the contribution by answering emails. So all of these things together make a beautiful monastery. So that's probably enough talk for this evening. And I offer that to you for your edification. And does anyone have any comments or questions?
Started to come here, and I think it the people here. I mean, imagine it'd be very hard to speak to a whole lot of people. It's hard enough living with one person and a dog.
Do you think we need a dog?
No, most of them not. They're most of the coming now and again.
Dog's a good one.
Do we have a dog?
Do
you have a dog?
Well, vegetarian dog.
Is your dog vegetarian?
No.
Oh, well, in that case. Yeah, absolutely. So what you mean the other way around?
Well, they're enlightened.
Yeah.
And just, it's not the putting out of the wick that's, you know, given to the realisation, it's just simultaneous.
If the wick was pulled out, my mind was free.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, yeah.
I would like that, just because it wasn't the one that there was just simultaneous. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a very mysterious process. Yeah. We have to see whether it still works with LEDs or not. I turned the LED light off and my mind is free.
I don't know if that only
works
by putting out my
video. We'll tell you about that a bit later on. Yeah, we haven't told you about the cross-dressing bit, no? Issues of ego. Ah, well, that's why all great rock and roll bands end, you know, pretty much. Yeah, ego is not a dirty word. But the, looking back at my band, then that's usually you come to a point where everybody thinks that you know, the reason why we're successful is because of me, yeah? And it's pretty much at that point that the band's doomed. And then you realise, of course, if you look at history, you know, so many times that's happened. Very, very few times then somebody's gone on to do a solo career which has worked. Yeah, occasionally it happens. Lou Reed, one example. Jimmy Barnes. Yeah. But generally speaking, the band breaks up and you never hear about them ever again. And so, you know, the actual kind of the voodoo is in what happens when that group of people come together. There's something special about that. So,
Well, then we usually complain about the kitchen as Islamic Central. I've been very inspired recently by just watching how a real sense of family is in the kitchen when everyone comes together and they wash the dishes together and have such harmony. In a way that you just ever see in my house, like, everyone in my house is really good with a chore, they come together and do it, but it's the way that we interact and we know each other and we chat, and it's just so natural, and I just think it's really beautiful. And it's something that I've really grown to appreciate. I think it's something that I don't feel lonely here.
The Buddha speaks of blending like milk and water, looking upon each other with kindly eyes. How do you think that fits in with what you were talking about at the beginning talk in regards to going into a situation where people all sort of share the same view? Do you think sometimes that can breed a culture of intolerance if everybody has to share the same view?
Yeah, for sure, yeah. Definitely, and that's kind of a danger of it. I think there's always that tendency, isn't there, that you kind of also you define yourself also in terms of rejection of the other. So one community finds its holds itself together by disparaging outsiders. I think that's a very, very prominent human quality. And of course, you find that in monastic circles. That, you can define yourself by pointing out what's wrong with Mahayana and what's wrong with the Christians and what's wrong with this and what's wrong with that. And so, yeah, I think that's important. I mean, that's always a sign of insecurity as well. That the more that you're confident within yourself, the less you feel the need to do those kinds of things. So that's something definitely needs to be need to remain aware of, and to not buy into that.
You think that's one of the